I'm Jeffrey Leppendorf, the Executive Director of the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses. This is the first time we're doing this. We're very thrilled to be doing this. The Council of Literary Magazines and Presses was founded back in 1967 to help independent literary publishers through the business of publishing, which is, as you probably know already and will certainly find out, a rather labyrinthine and complicated process. And when the literary agents Nat Sobel and Judith Weber came to us with this idea to do something specifically for writers, we knew that it was the perfect thing for us to be doing. The fact is that the publishing process involves many, many partnerships. As I just said, we help small publishers maneuver this sort of crazy process, and you writers need to know how that works as well so that you can be involved and not just leave it to your publisher. I think you're all told that art is 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. What many of you know already and will find out soon is that the time to really start sweating is when your book is about to be published, not while writing it. So we're here to help dab away some of that perspiration, make it a little easier, a little friendlier, and to empower you to maneuver that labyrinth a little easier. So without further ado, I want to introduce our first MC, Sarah Nelson of Publishers Weekly, who will introduce our very, very esteemed panel and get this conference going. Thank you all for being here.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hi. I'm glad you all came tonight. Thank you for coming. And we have a really distinguished panel of publishers who I think you've probably all heard of, and I know you've read their books. I'm going to read brief introductions of each panelist, and then I will ask a couple of questions, get the ball rolling, and then I really would like to turn this into as much of a conversation as we can among the panelists, so please don't, you guys don't be polite to each other, and just jump in, raise your hands, and we'll ask some questions. Immediately to my left is Sunny Mehta, who's the editor-in-chief of Alfred A. Knopf, one of the world's most distinguished book publishing houses. He's also chairman of the Knopf Publishing Group, which includes Knopf, Pantheon Books, Schocken Books, and Vintage Anchor. Mr. Mehta began his publishing career in London at Rupert Hart Davis Limited and went on to found Paladin Books. He then became editorial director of Granada Paperbacks, comprising the Panther, Mayflower, and Paladin imprints. In 1972, he became editorial director and later publishing director of Pan Books, where he was instrumental in establishing the highly successful Picador Trade paperback imprint. Sonny moved to New York in 1987 to head Alfred A. Knopf. He has since maintained and enhanced Knopf's international reputation for literature and bookmaking of the highest quality. Long the publisher of such renowned writers as Thomas Mann, Willa Cather, John Hersey, John Updike, Andre Gide, and Albert Camus, Knopf has in recent years also published, this is quite some list, Toni Morrison, V.S. Naipaul, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Richard Russo, Richard Ford, Orhan Pamuk, Dr. Andrew Weil, Ann Tyler, Ann Rice, and Cormac McCarthy. Together, authors published by Knopf have won 24 Nobel Prizes, and they have also been leading recipients of Pulitzer Prizes, National Book Awards, and other honors. Next up, we have Jonathan Burnham, was born in London and educated at Oxford, where he reads Italian and French, and took an MLit in Italian 20th century poetry. He's worked in publishing since 1986, first as publishing director of Chatto and Windus, one of the most distinguished literary lists in the UK. Then he was president of Miramax Books here from 1999 to 2005, where his list included several best-selling authors, including Michael Chabon, Secretary Madeleine Albright, Martin Amis, and Her Majesty Queen Noor, and published a number of best-selling children's authors, including, okay, how do you pronounce it? Owen Colfer, author of the Artemis Fowl series. He's currently senior vice president and publisher of HarperCollins and lives in New York. Next we have Jonathan Galassi, who was born in Seattle, Washington. He attended Phillips Exeter Academy and Harvard College and Cambridge University, where he earned an MA in 1973. Jonathan Galassi became an editor in the trade division of Houghton Mifflin Company in 1973. He was a senior editor at Random House from 1981 to 1986, when he joined Farrar, Straus, and Giroux as vice president and executive editor. He was named president in 2002. Jonathan Galassi has published two books of poems and has translated several volumes of the work of the Italian poet Eugenio Montale. He is honorary chairman of the Academy of American Poets and a member of the Board of Overseers at the California Institute of the Arts. And last but not least, Morgan Entrekin was born in 19... Why don't we say that? We don't say that about anybody else. Morgan Entrekin grew up in Nashville, Tennessee. After graduating from Stanford in the Radcliffe Publishing course, he joined Delacorte Press in 1977, where he worked with such authors as Kurt Vonnegut, Jane Ann Phillips, Craig Nova, and Richard Brautigan. In 1982, he moved to Simon & Schuster, where he acquired books by Richard Ford, Bret Easton Ellis, and Dr. Michael DeBakey. In 1984, he left to start his own imprint at Atlantic Monthly Press. Over 40 titles were published under the Morgan Entrekin Books Atlantic Monthly Press imprint, including books by P.J. O'Rourke, Rian Mallon, Richard Preston, Ron Chernow, and Francisco Goldman. In 1991, Morgan acquired, with a group of investors, Atlantic Monthly Press. In 1993, he merged the company with Grove Press, publisher Samuel Beckett, William Burroughs, and Harold Pinter, among others. Morgan is currently the president and publisher of Grove Atlantic, which publishes 120 titles a year in North America and 75 books under the Atlantic Books imprint in London. Grove Atlantic authors include P.J. O'Rourke, Mark Bowden, Kieran Desai, Jim Harrison, Tim Flannery, Richard Flanagan, Sherman Alexie, Michael Tolkien, Faye Weldon, Ken Zabora Owe, and Tom Stoppard. Okay, the first question I thought I would just throw out to the panel, and whoever wants to answer it can answer it, is we're here to talk about literary fiction, and I was thinking about how there's a famous quote from a Supreme Court justice, but of course I can't remember which one it is, who said that he didn't know what pornography was, but he knew it when he saw it. So I think we all talk about literary fiction, we all publish literary fiction, we read literary fiction. But I would be interested in somebody trying to define literary fiction. Anybody?
Well, you know, I'll start because I had a conversation at lunch on exactly that topic with a friend of mine from Nashville who's here, Todd, wherever you are out there. But we drew a continuum. I said, over here is commercial and over here is literary, and it's sort of there's a line in between. And the phrase that I used was that literary fiction is fiction that seeks to entertain and enlighten, whereas commercial fiction is fiction that simply seeks to entertain. And that was the simple way for me to define it. But I think it's a fungible concept, and somebody's idea of what's literary is not necessarily everybody else's idea of what's literary.
I agree, actually. And I think the other thing, Sarah mentioned this before we came in, I was just thinking, with commercial fiction, you can usually see how it's done. You can usually see what the intention is, what the author's trying to do. But with literary fiction, it does more than it seems to on the page. In other words, you're not quite clear what it is that the novelist is after, and after you've stopped reading, you're not quite sure what it is he or she has done. So I think it comes into that category somehow.
Well, you know, I do think you recognize it when you see it, but like sort of you can tell good fish from bad fish, but ultimately it sets out to try to sort of make sense of the world, at least that's how I react to it. And anything that makes sense of the world, I think we need it.
You could almost say that literary fiction is everything that isn't something, it isn't some other genre. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a straight historical novel, it's not mystery, it's not a thriller, it's sort of by subtraction, you could say, it's everything else. But I think it's true that, to me, it's more about the voice of the author is really dominant over other conventions. That's not enough, but that's, mm-hmm. I would say that's the...
Is it less plot-oriented,
plot-driven?
I mean, that would be... It can be.
Yeah.
But not necessarily.
No. I mean, any of those other genres could actually... A book could also be a literary book that was a thriller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dennis Lehane would be an example of that. Word is very hard on the literary.
Stephen King could have
been. Yeah, yes, I would say.
I write about this all the time, and other people do too, copying me, of course. I think, there is a perception in the, certainly in the journalist community, the people who cover the book business, but I think also in the consumer world, that literary fiction doesn't sell, that you can't have the expectations of huge sales. The Da Vinci Code is not literary fiction, literary fiction does not sell the way the Da Vinci Code sells, and that you're sort of crazy to expect that it would, should, or could. I wondered if you could each talk about, I think literary fiction is a little bit under siege in this environment, in this community, and I wonder if you could talk about why you're all passionately committed to it, that's what you all do, and why you stick with it, why you don't just throw in the towel and publish celebrity biographies.
Because they don't sell as well.
No, Johnson's got a point. I mean, not all celebrity biographies sell. He's right about that.
I'm being slightly...
Yeah, but I don't think that literary fiction is under siege. I think that it's a healthier time for literary fiction than ever in my 30-year career. I think literary fiction sells better than it ever has in my career. I mean, maybe there was a heyday in the 90s where we hit a real high note. There was one moment...
Spoken by somebody whose book just won the Booker Prize.
Well, yeah, but come on, everybody else up here has had literary successes in the last few years that dwarf, some of ours. But there was a moment in 1998... where Charles Fraser's Cold Mountain, Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things, and Arthur Golden's Memoirs of a Geisha, all three literary novels, all three first novels, were on the New York Times bestseller list at the same time. And those books combined, I don't know the numbers on Arundhati Roy or The Geisha, but are north of 8 or 10 million, probably north of 15 million worldwide. So Sonny, you're looking at me skeptically. You don't think literary fiction is selling?
No, I think you're absolutely right about it. I think there's always an occasion when there are books on the bestseller list that are literary fiction. But I'm not talking... The bestseller list is only one index by which we can gauge success. But even going back to that, there were an awful lot of other novels and short story collections published in the period that you've just talked about that found not enough readers. And I think that is part of what is a perpetual situation as far as fiction is concerned, that some books really do find an audience, but there's an awful lot that have very few takers, and that's, I think, the heartbreaking part of what we're all involved in.
And I think it's getting more so. There's more and more a winner-take-all situation.
That's right. I agree with that.
A few books get all the attention and they roll out. And I think when Morgan says it's the best time ever for literary fiction, I think that's especially true in trade paperback. I think it's harder and harder in hardcover. You can make up for that with wonderful numbers in trade, but I've found that launching new literary writers in the last few years, since 9/11 in particular, has been harder and harder. I was really happy this fall to see The Emperor's Children succeed so well. It's the first time I've seen an author who's published a number of books sort of succeed the old-fashioned way. She sort of built up an audience, and finally she got where she deserved to be.
It's Claire Massoud's novel that's published by Knopf, right?
Yeah. But I would say that's very much the exception to what's going on.
And the other example would be Marisha Pessel, I think, in the same season, which was a first novel. It wasn't particularly... the campaign to build it up wasn't particularly intense, but it broke through.
Briefly,
but brightly, I say.
But I think it's very... maybe I'm confessing too much, but I think that it's been harder and harder to get people to care about something new, to get things to turn over, and... it's very depressing to me.
I agree.
You mentioned 9/11, Jonathan. Did you?
Somebody has a question here.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I was thinking there's kind of a feeling that it's almost impossible to get the first novel published, even harder to get the second. Where it seems to me that most writers develop through grassroots, through publicly multiple books and generating fan base to something comfortable with it, really comfortable with the work. How do you, as publishers, deal with the fact that party is going to go public, that the person doesn't necessarily sell, but then losing, you know, any kind of like body of book in the long run?
And I think that that is a bad thing that's happened, is that it's easier to publish a first book than it is to publish a third or fourth book. That's not the way it used to be. For those of us who are old enough, remember 25 or 30 years ago, the model was that you published a few novels and you built an audience over time and then you broke through. Now the model is you have to have a novel that does very, very well in a dramatic way as a launch, or else it is very difficult for the second, third, fourth book. And you know, I think that that's unfortunate, and part of that comes from the computerized inventory systems that the sales, that the stores have, so that they can, you ask the store to take, if it's a national account, Barnes & Noble or Borders, to take 2,000 copies for all their stores, and they'll usually support you, but if they sell 400 of those 2,000, they're going to have a hard time when you come back the next time taking 2,000, and so that is inevitable. One of the things that I've done in the last 2 years is to relaunch an old Grove imprint called Black Cat and do trade paperback original fiction, because what I found was happening was that the hardcovers were taking 70 or 80% return rate. You then weren't getting many orders for the paperbacks, and the author wasn't having any continuing life in the marketplace. Their books weren't in the stores. Whereas what now happens is we get 6 or 8,000 copy orders for the trade paperbacks, and they sell, and they stay in the stores. And then the next time you come with that second novel, the store is happy to see you. You know, they say, oh, yeah, that one, we'll take some more of that book. Neither the author makes as much money and the publisher doesn't make as much money, but it's a positive experience for everyone.
But, Morgan, don't you find that there's sudden resistance? I mean,
yeah.
There's disappointment from the author, from the agent.
Yeah, they think that it somehow diminishes the book if it's going to be a paperback.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
It's not sitting at the grown-ups table to get published
in
paperback first.
And the reviews
yeah, but
were
you know,
coming.
Having said all of that, most of us try to find a way of publishing that second novel.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be pretty devastating if you don't stick with a writer at least for a while. I think all of us think it's part of our job.
Yes, because we're publishing authors, not just
books.
But No, I don't think so. If you can start out with Harper or Knopf, I think that's probably a better idea.
No, I was going to say, but also the it could be a cruel fate too if your first novel is over. Well, in other words, if you're suddenly going to lucky enough, you think, to get a huge advance, a huge embrace from a big publisher. That can be a curse, too. It might actually be better. It is better, I think, to start modestly, whether it's a paperback original or a reasonable print run and a reasonable set of expectations and grow from there.
But that's not the way the market is working right now,
yeah.
Is it? And I think it's a sign of ill health that there's an awful lot of pressure to acquire, I don't know how there's a lot of pressure to, I don't know who the pressure is applied to, but books are competed for at a very high level by publishers in a frenzied.
There are so few of them, and there are so many.
Well, I mean, it's a sort of blockbuster mentality. This is the sort of movie business.
But it's a
spillover
sudden death.
Mentality,
it's sudden
right?
death for a lot of people.
You got to open big. You know, you got to make a big splash, and that's sort of antithetical to the idea of publishing. But I think, I mean, do you think that that some of that has to do with the fact that publishers are now many publishers are owned by large entertainment conglomerates? Is that why? I mean, is that part of why? No.
Well, the only reason that would be is that they have the money.
Right.
That's true.
Right.
So the money is there.
Yes, exactly.
If we were all small independents, the money wouldn't be there, and so that wouldn't happen.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, I can explain that as a small or mid-sized independent is that when my competitors are evaluating a decision to pay X number of hundreds of thousands of dollars, their decision usually is about the risk-reward. How much am I risking versus what the potential reward is? And downside, they're not having to worry about where the money is going to come from. And if they tie the money up in Project A, they won't have the money for Projects B, C, and D. That's not true for me. If I tie a lot of money up in A, I mean, somewhat.
Somebody in that company should be worried.
Yeah, but you have access to capital that I don't. And publishers didn't used to have that access to capital. It's a very capital-intensive business, and they didn't used to have it.
On the other hand, you screw up enough, they're going to let you know.
We talk a little bit about, I mean, once books are acquired, I mean, a big part of publishing, obviously, is marketing and distributing the books. I mean, it's one thing to find them. I mean, that's hard enough. It's, but getting them out there into the stores, getting publicity for them, there's less and less newspaper, fewer and fewer newspaper pages available. You know, how do you go about marketing and promoting and selling a literary book, a book that doesn't have an obvious pop culture hook, I mean, or celebrity hook or something like that?
Yeah. I want to know how you do it.
I don't know. I think, first of all, it does help. It does help if there is a story behind the book. Not a celebrity story, but just a story behind the creation of the book, where the author came from, how the book came to be published. That gives you something to hold on to. That gives you a starting point to getting that crucial thing, which is coverage off the book's page, because the competition for space on the book's page is ridiculously intense. And in a funny way, it's easier to get a feature than it is to get a review in many cases these days.
And sells more books.
And sells more books.
An outstanding example, actually, right now, is that French novel that you've just bought, which has already got more ink than most established novelists get.
It's a 1,000-page long novel, which was published in France in September, and is a big bestseller there, and HarperCollins just bought the rights. But it's had an enormous amount. The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, other newspapers have covered it as if it were as a literary phenomenon, which is rare.
And that's self-fulfilling. So now, when you publish 18 months, 24 months from now, there'll be more stories because it's a big story.
Well,
but that's the same thing. Something similar happened with Sweet Française, Namorowski book that was published about sort of 8 months ago, which. And the story behind that was that it was an uncompleted but quite extensive sequence of novels which were discovered in a suitcase left behind by the author before she was taken off to a concentration camp where she subsequently died. And that was the story, and it's a wonderful sequence of novels, but that story did help get the attention of about a year before we published it.
I think sometimes you run the risk that that's going to backfire, though, too. That I mean, a book that, I mean, not we hope for anybody sitting here, but that, you know, a book gets a lot of attention a year and a half before it appears. You know, A, does the public, I mean, we know and we care and we remember, but does the public know? Do they remember, and you know, and does it raise their expectations in a way that sometimes, you know, can disappoint? I mean, this is not a book that did disappoint, but you know, that you oversell it too early. Is that a fear or a possibility, or are you just happy to sell it whenever you
I'm
can?
I'm happy to
get
the more you can get, the more attention you can get.
That's
the better.
More attention you get, the more attention you get.
Right.
Yeah,
so
that's absolutely.
But good for books generally, I think, to sort of.
That they're part of a conversation.
Yes.
But I think that, Sarah, what you've raised, this idea of the difficulty of making people aware of literary fiction, and I think it's a crisis that we're all going to confront, is that reviews don't sell books the way that they used to. And I think first of all, young people don't read newspapers, and they just don't have the impact. The big reviews don't have the impact that they used to. And I think that one of the things that I'm worried about and trying to figure out is, what are we going to do? How are we going to get people in the conversation about literary fiction? And I don't know the answer. The other thing that's happened is, as the retail side of the business has become more and more consolidated with Barnes & Noble and Borders more than independent stores, and there's good and bad things to that. Barnes & Noble and Borders have wonderful selection of books and they're in communities that never used to have bookstores, but they don't always have the same relationship with their customer that a local bookseller did. And what you used to be able to do with literary fiction was seed it within those community, those local booksellers around the country, get them reading and talking about it. And now, you know, I think that Barnes & Noble and Borders do a very admirable job of supporting the literary fiction that we publish anyway, and that they'll let me take a chance, and that they are incredibly conscientious for people who are so overloaded with responsibility in terms of making decisions about what's bought in literary fiction. But the bottom line is they don't quite have that same relationship. And so I don't know what we're going to do. I don't know how we're going to do it. The internet is an obvious way to do it. With community, one of the things that we're trying to do is take our website and make it more not just a business-to-business, but to bring people in and to bring people into the conversation so that anybody who's interested in fiction is reading my books or communicating with me in some way, I'm trying to bring into a conversation.
We're all trying those things, but nobody has, it has yet to be shown that this really has...
You can use it for nonfiction easily.
Yeah, much more easily.
You get bloggers on it. You get that whole internet thing going for nonfiction.
Can I also raise something? I just discovered today, which is that there are two books, two novels, which were shortlisted for the National Book Awards, both published by within the larger HarperCollins umbrella. Neither of which have sold anything. Like, I mean, the sales are in the low four figures still for both books. And it's very striking to me. I mean, I'm only recently arrived in America, but the National Book Awards, even at the shortlist stage, should have zero effect in terms of changing the sales picture for a book. Or maybe am I being naive? Has that always been?
I think at the shortlist phase, they don't. But if one of those books is lucky enough to win, you'll get.
There is a definite.
Yes. And it depends on varying factors, the degree of bump that you get.
I think Jonathan is reacting very much like as I did when I came from England, where the whole idea of selecting a group of books and like The Booker is the outstanding example, but it's not the only one. There's The Whitbread, there's the Samuel Johnson. And my impression is that the only prize like that has anything like that impact is the Pulitzer.
That's my impression. Well, in Britain, there's a lot of betting on the thing. There's more of a sort of national conversation.
There's
about
a national
this.
Media. There's a national literary media. We don't have a national literary
media.
That's true. We don't have a national media. The Pulitzer Prize does have a big impact here in certain areas, but it's a very journalistically canted prize, and there's no discussion in advance of what the nominees are, so that you don't have those opportunities to kind of build interest. Mm-hmm. We piggyback off the Booker ourselves here, because that noise comes across the ocean, but we're not very good at making that noise ourselves.
Yeah, but what you're looking for is someone other than the publisher saying a book is a good book. That's why we look for blurbs from other writers. That's why, you know, and a prize does that.
Exactly.
It helps a little bit. What it does, it might not sell the book. I don't know. I remember when we were publishing Cold Mountain, at the very last minute, we got a quote from John Berendt, the author of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, and I did it in a gold sticker on the cover. And more than one person said to me when I would hand them a copy, oh, it already won a prize. And it was like, no, it hadn't, but it made people think it might have. And it's like, I will do a sticker for almost any prize, you know, and it because it's something that helps in the store. Look, I go into the store and I'm overwhelmed by the selection of what to read, and it's something that's got a good imprimatur on it. And I was, you know, somebody was asking me the other day of what is all this stuff with the quotes and the blurbs, and I go, look, yeah, there's a little bit of it that's kind of, you know, bullshit, but the fact is that some of it's real, and when I'm picking up a book in the store, if there's a smart critic who's written a smart review that's articulated the book in an interesting way to me, that will make me pick that book up. So I work very hard. I oversee almost every pull from the quotes of every paperback we publish because I want to phrase it right, and I try to teach my young people this, you know, go to this kernel of it, and you've also got to obey certain rules. You can't cheat and pull out, like, one phrase from a bad review. And
plenty of people do.
Yeah, you can't. You're not, don't you all agree those are the rules? You can't do that.
If it's a bad enough review, it's very tempting.
Exactly.
Well, there's some bad reviews that are selling reviews, yeah, right? And there's some good reviews that don't sell books. So,
I think that American readers, a lot of them, are waiting to be told by somebody that they ought to read this book.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's not by Nietzsche, necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's by their friend, it's someone in their book club.
Oprah,
someone on television. But there are a lot, I think there are a lot of people who are very unsure about going into a bookstore and choosing something themselves. And I mm-hmm. think that's a big problem for, and that's more that people, readers are not loyal to authors anymore. They'll read X by Y, but they won't read X plus one by Y.
Right.
They'll read the next book that was chosen by somebody else.
I remember that there were studies done. I mean, people looked at the numbers after when Oprah was first starting her book club, and you know, she would have these enormous sales for the whatever book she picked, and then the backlist wouldn't move at all because they were making the connection between, you know, if I like this author.
But oddly, that doesn't apply in commercial fiction. It's the opposite.
Commercial fiction, because that has a more serious kind of quality.
Well, they want the same experience to be repeated.
Exactly, with a slight variation.
That's the difference between literary
fiction. Yeah, we just discovered it.
Good. Say that again.
That's one of the differences between literary and commercial fiction, is that you want a new experience with literary fiction.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about backlist? I mean, so, you know, we all spend a lot of time publicizing and marketing the front list, but there are many people who feel that the older books, the paperback reprints, the backlist is what, you know, is really sort of the heart and soul of the business. Do you believe that? How much of your business is backlist?
50%.
50%.
Which makes me very happy.
Right.
It's why I can relax.
Between 50 and 60.
Yeah.
By that, we really do mean, personal, we're talking about the paperbacks, which is really essentially the permanent form of the backlist on any publisher's catalog.
And everyone here understands the difference, right? The backlist are the older books that you've published. I mean, we use a definition that the book has to be in print for 2 years before we start calling it backlist. And you can predict those sales. Like, I can predict how many sales I'm going to have of Naked Lunch every year within 5%. If a movie happens on a book, of course, that'll be a good experience. But you rarely will you be disappointed. Whereas the new books, which is the front list, you have no idea. You know, you publish a novel and you ship 10,000 and you might sell 40 or you might sell 3. And you have to spend money on marketing. So the front list publishing is much, much more difficult. But one of the things that you play for, and the reason that you publish in a financial analysis of it for literary fiction, is literary fiction is much more likely to backlist than something, the commercial stuff that's going to disappear. It's the core of the Grove backlist. Many books are decades old, and the same with Knopf and Farrar, Straus, and Harper.
Which plays somewhat to your answer about how you can build a writer. I think most of us use the fact that we have a book on the backlist to sort of build an awareness, mm-hmm. a growing mm-hmm. awareness of a writer's career and the continuity of it. Because actually most writers whom we are very excited to publish really did start off, whether it's Richard Ford or Michael Ondaatje, selling extremely modestly. As a matter of fact, Richard published as a
Houghton first, that's what one piece of my heart was Harper, and then wasn't the second one Ultimate Good Luck was Houghton.
Yeah,
but
and
what
then the third was the paperback
original. The third was Sports Writer in Vintage Contemporaries. Gary did it. But you know, an interesting exercise is when writers say to me, well, you're going to publish your first novel, and all they've read about in the newspaper are, you know, Jonathan Safran Foer or that Viking young woman, I can't remember her name you just mentioned, who have gotten hundreds of thousands of dollars in advance and sold X number of, you know, hundreds of thousands of copies. And I think, and I say to my editors, one of the things is if you control people's expectations and educate them about the experience, they can go through and have the exact same experience and either come out of it feeling good or come out of it feeling really disappointed and bad. And one of the exercises I do is name 3 or 4 of your favorite writers for me, Richard Ford, you know, John Irving, Toni Morrison. None of those writers' first novels sold 10,000 copies. None of them. And then, you know, you put that into several of them, their first three books didn't sell 10,000 copies combined. Cormac's a great example. He never sold 5,000 copies of a book until, yeah. And so you put that in context and people understand, well, you know, maybe it wasn't so bad that I ended up selling 6,000 copies of my book where everybody makes me feel like a failure because I'm not.
But we're living in a culture, Morgan, where that's increasingly difficult to sustain. That's the truth. Yeah. I mean, don't you think?
I agree, but we don't have enough information because the fact is all of us are saying that's true of our successful middle-aged writers now. All we've built them over 15 or 20 years. That's the old-fashioned way. That's what. But I'm not sure that the new way is really a way, because we don't know enough to know.
That's true.
So we haven't seen the repetition with these people, and so.
But that comes back to my sort of thinking behind doing trade paperback original is at least you keep the books in the marketplace. Whereas under that model where you're taking 70% hardcover returns and then, you know, you're getting nothing out of the paperback, and within 2 years, those writers' books aren't on the bookshelves.
I mean, backlist, it's wonderful, but it's not, I mean, there's the backlist that sells and there's the rest. And, you know, and the backlist that sells is a very small part of it. It needs to be worked all the time. It's not like you don't have to market your back.
And you have to renew it.
That's true.
Jackets.
You have to refresh it. You have to publish it. Yeah. So.
We've got some questions.
It's interesting. I'm hearing a voice about marketing, and then I hear a little bit of voice about authors. And I'm wondering when the author might need to start thinking about the marketing, or should he just remove himself from that at first? I mean, what is he started off saying that the voice was what literary fiction was all about. And it seems to me, just as a writer, that the marketing was really frustrating.
It depends on your personality and what your own needs are, I think.
I personally believe that writers should work on writing and not worry about canting their books to the market and they should try to develop confidence with their voice and then help find professionals to help them with the other. But if you try and sort of play the market, I think you're putting the cart before the horse myself.
Right, I agree.
I feel like eventually that question does come up to the writer. And you find, I mean, as an individual that you bring this up to, I mean, I don't know about that.
You mean
up to the writers? Is it something that's important for them to say, what's your market? I mean, certainly it took a lot of writers.
No.
Literary fiction, you can't define the market like that. It doesn't have a definition.
It creates its own market if
I mean, there's some exception. I once said to a writer that was very disappointed in the sales of his book, I seem to have a lot of them, but he had written this marvelous collection of interconnected stories. He's in his 20s, but they're very dark. The setting was very dark. It was, you know, among sort of street people and edgy. And it was like, I said to him, you know, you've got to be realistic about your subject, your choice of your subject matter is probably going to diminish somewhat the potential of reaching the audience. And also the style was, you know, challenging a bit. And it was marvelous. And he got marvelous reviews and, in my opinion, launched his career in a positive way. But he was very disappointed that the book didn't sell, you know, 40, 60,000 copies. And I said, that's unrealistic expectation. So I think a little bit, if your personal needs are that you want to sell 40 to 60,000 copies, you perhaps shouldn't write about heroin addicts at some, you know, I mean, just, I don't know. I mean, maybe you can and maybe they will, but there is going to be some implication from your subject matter choices. Wouldn't you agree? A little bit. I mean.
Yeah, but I think people need to write what they need to write.
I agree with the world. I had lunch today with an author called Lionel Shriver who was talking about how she'd written, I think, 8 novels, none of which had sold. And then her 9th novel was a novel about a mother who turns violently against her own son. It's about a school shooting. She said it was the darkest novel I'd written. I thought it was one that wouldn't sell. And of course, it won the Orange Prize. Right. It sold 250,000 copies. So in a way, you never know.
I published 3 or 4 books by Lam, her first book.
Right.
She's a great writer, but
she's terrific.
I had a hard time selling them. That's
pretty good, too.
Yeah, it is good. It is good.
Is there a skill that determines the success of a novel or a book? I mean, do you look at, say, 3 months after publication, you have to have sold 10,000 or 20,000 copies, or it will lead to the true that success?
Well,
is there a number? I mean, the music industry has gold records and exact numbers. I mean, do we have anything like that?
No.
I mean, what is the sale to one of the success? What the sales?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously, no, it is to you to answer, but I think, you know, I think it depends on a lot of things. I think it depends on the expectations you brought to it. I think it depends on what you paid for it. You know, if you pay $1 million for a book and it sells 10,000 copies, you're going to be, that's not a good thing. If you pay, you know.
That's a failure.
That's a failure. Thank you, Sonny. That's a failure. But if you pay, you know, $100,000 or $20,000 for a book and it sells 50,000 copies, that's
a
big
success.
Deal.
Yes.
So, I mean, I think it goes back to the sort of business side of what Morgan was talking about, which is depends to some extent what you bring to the, what expectations you bring and what you put out there.
But the first book that sold, got tremendous reception and sold 5 or 6,000 copies could be a success, too.
I agree.
It could be
totally agree.
The platform you need to go ahead.
Absolutely.
And then you could go into paperback and sell 30 or 40,000 in the first 2 or 3 years. And that, to me, would be...
We would all agree that would be a pretty good level of success.
In the back? You remember you paid a fee to be a member of a book club and you got a certain number of books a year. But this is one publisher doing this. I'm not familiar. Is this Softball is doing it?
But that's a small imprint with a very sort of definite personality and focus. But with lists like Knopf or Harper, it would be difficult.
But it's interesting. It's an interesting.
I think it. It's great if you can create the customer base that believes that every book that's published by Atlantic is going to be potentially of interest. But creating that is really not, in a way, how our business has been structured. Maybe we should be working towards that. Mm-hmm. You know, building brand awareness. That's
I would say the last thing that did that in general trade fiction in America was Vintage Contemporaries. That. Wouldn't you say, Sonny, in a way? That like that was launched in the early 80s, and it included the first year, or I'm not sure, maybe the first 18 months anyway, was Bright Lights, Big City, Sports Writer by Richard Ford, reissues of books by Peter Matheson, Cormac McCarthy, Tom McGuane, and it sort of had, the books had a series look. Gary Fiskejohn was the one that launched it, and he hired a designer that had done some record albums, right. And I think that they bought some real estate in the store, went to that imprint to get a certain kind of book that they knew was a certain quality. But in fact, what two things happened. Many other publishers started to imitate them, and it got too crowded, and the list got too broad and lost a little bit of its identity. And then you also did the internationals, the Vintage Internationals. Was that while you just before you came or right as you left?
Yeah.
And did an international publishing that way. But I think that it does, as someone said, have to be a very focused list, because otherwise there's too much variety and not everybody would like every book.
I mean, in England there's more brand awareness, like Faber, for instance, is an imprint that has a specific identity and people will buy Faber books because they're published.
Grove had it in the 60s a little bit.
Yeah,
and Picadol did it.
Yeah,
think,
that's true.
With a conscience, actually, for a while.
So, yeah. In the UK?
Yes, yeah. Yes, totally.
But the UK market is a very different market. It's a much smaller, more, it, number. I mean, yeah, the country's much smaller. And
it's also, I think the written word occupies a place over there that it, a centrality that I, mean, I wonder whether it does over here.
But does anybody in here buy a book because of who publishes it? No. You do?
Well,
yeah. Well, then you're very knowledgeable.
They're writers.
Right. Yes, exactly. I mean, I remember when I was in college in the 70s and I was studying and sort of informing myself about contemporary American fiction, that I would buy books by New Directions, Grove, and Fiction Collective because I knew they would be interesting and edgy and some, and I could discover new writers that way.
Right.
But, and I still, you know, but I'm in the business. I can recognize a certain imprint, certain places.
But. Right, but I think what worked with Vintage and with those that you're talking about is that there was some cohesive, there was, you know, the book sort of looked similar, and so, you know, you did have, and you're a real reader. I mean, you're not waiting for Oprah to tell you what
to buy. They reflected an editor's taste.
Right, yes, it was an editor's collection, you know, and I think that, but there are not that many people, like you. I mean, it goes back to the Oprah tells you what book, but you don't go to the back.
Because I want them to buy my book, not his book. We're competitors. We're competing for the. I mean, this is a facetious answer, but we're competing for the attention. We're competing for the time and attention of people, but we're actually, we have common interests too. So, but I think that, you know, when someone goes to buy books, they're going to buy a book or two books. So it's,
well, what's your idea of what we should all be doing?
Explain the concept.